A quick note, at Focus Corp, we don't just do retained executive search, but we also place interim finance and accounting professionals. If your team's down a headcount, or covering a long leave, or you're tackling a special project, or you're just slammed, we can get experienced bilingual talent to you fast. Reach out. My contact details are in the show notes. Now, on to our show. Hi, it's Dave Sweet, founder and CEO of Focus Corp. Thanks for listening to the Focus Corp podcast. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the Focus Corp 2025 salary guide has been released. We're there with some great insights, not only for information about salaries in Japan, but insights about job market, hiring, and what's important to both companies and individuals looking for a job specifically in Japan. There's a link for that in the show notes. Please take a look. And now on to our program.
One of the big learnings you have in Japan, I think, is when you come into the business and there are some things that seem a bit odd, or this seems expensive, why are we doing it this way, or this is not very effective, and you just can't quite work it out. But you find that your team are very dogmatic about protecting that and not changing anything. And, well, what's wrong with these people? We're very stubborn. I better fire these people, get some people in here who know how to make things happen, right? If you go and talk to the clients, if you go and talk to your buyers, that's when you discover why your own team is being dogmatic, because they're very closely aligned with the needs of the buyers.
Yeah.
And they're trying to really serve them extremely well. And the buyers have certain demands. And so they sort of force your machine to make some adjustments, which for you make no sense, but from the Japanese buyer's point of view, makes sense. So I think if you send in people who maybe they don't know Japan, they're not bilingual, but give them the freedom of time to get results.
Welcome to the Focus Corp podcast. Today, we're not going to criticize, condemn, or complain. My guest is very busy. On Monday, he has the Cutting Edge podcast and video show. On Tuesday, the Presentation Japan Series podcast. On Wednesday, the Sales Japan Series podcast. On Thursday, the Leadership Japan Series podcast. Friday, the Japan Business Mastery podcast and video show. And for your weekend pleasure, Japan's Top Business Interviews podcast and video show. I'm so lucky to have Dr. Greg Story with me today, who most of you might know. He has been a good friend of mine since back in donkey's years. I don't want to go back that far, but I think I met him when he was Austrade as the GM, and then moved over to Shinsei, where we had lunch and learned we had a lot of things in common, and then did some work together when you were at NAB, at the National Australia Bank. So Dr. Story is a renowned leader and sales expert, especially in Japan, but I think globally would be my take on it. With three decades of experience in Japan, he's president of Dale Carnegie Japan, and a global master trainer and author of three best-selling books, one of them that he has here today with his...
Well, this one's not a bestseller yet. It's hopefully going to become a bestseller, but it's the Sales Japan, the Leadership Japan presentation, all bestsellers. This is only released this year, so
we haven't
quite cracked the code on the bestseller.
We'll get there.
We're working on that one.
And that'll be the first one we talk about. And so I talk Japan Sales Mastery and Japan Business Mastery are the other two that you have. So with a background that spans from executive coaching to business strategy, Dr. Story is a master at helping individuals and companies achieve their goals in the Japanese market. And today we'll dive into his insights on leadership, communication, and the unique dynamics of doing business in Japan. Welcome, Dr. Story.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here again. Now, this is interesting because last time we were in this room, I was interviewing you for my podcast. So it's terrific that we're back together again. And this time it's for your podcast, because that time you didn't have a podcast.
I did not have a podcast.
That time, right? And saying you've got a very well-established and very successful podcast. And I listened to your podcast too. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
You get some great guests as well.
So thank you. Well, now I have a great guest in you.
Oh, thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
So for those that are listening that may not know you, and for a lot of our listeners that are outside Japan, let's dive into you and who you are.
Sure.
So walk us up to today.
Okay. So I'm an Aussie. My family, actually, we're six generations in Australia. Okay. Originally came from Bristol, outside of Bristol, a place called Headbury Village, I suppose. In 1834, they sailed around to Tasmania.
Okay.
And it was just raw bush. And so they, you know, developed it, farming. And then one of my ancestors was chasing gold and went from Tasmania to Victoria and then north and wound up in Queensland. And you have Wells Fargo in America, which was a messaging transportation service. And you had a special springs that could take the rugged roads. And they brought the same technology to Australia. They brought it from America. In Australia, the company is called Cobb & Co. Mm-hmm. And Cobb & Co, my ancestor was actually a manager for Cobb & Co out in the bush. Eventually became a parliamentarian in the Queensland Parliament and was very successful in having a listed agricultural company. Mm-hmm. So somehow, at some point in time, the stories had a fair bit of dough. Where did it go?
Yeah.
Where did it go? Hasn't trickled down to me. But I grew up in Brisbane, and I did modern Asian studies at university, studying Chinese. Mm-hmm. But I always wanted to do Japanese because my Japanese interest through karate. I've been training over 50 years in karate now. So eventually I got a Monbusho scholarship. In those days it was Monbusho, not Monbukasho like it is now, but to come to Japan and study Japanese, which I did. And then after 2 years, I realized I couldn't say anything, needed more. So I was able to stay on if I took it up to the next level, which is a master's degree, which I did. So I stayed for another 2.5 years. And then I decided to become an academic. I thought, I like university, I like learning, I like teaching, getting paid to do this is fantastic. I want to get paid to do this as a full-time profession. So, if you want to become a professor, you need a union ticket. And that union ticket is called a PhD. Mm. And you've got one, and I've got one, right? Mm. So we got the union ticket if we want to be a teacher. So I went down the track of becoming a doctor of philosophy, majoring in political science and national relations. And I came back I went to see a 79, 83, went home, did the fieldwork, came back, fieldwork prep, came back, fieldwork 84, 85, went back home, then spent years writing the thesis up because it was Sino-Japanese relations. I had massive amounts of materials in Chinese I had to translate, massive amounts of materials in Japanese I had to translate. There were no English source materials. Mm-hmm. What I was doing is very original. Also a nightmare. And then just on the brink of going for interviews to become a professor, there was a boom. You remember the 90s, yep. Right? It was go, go, go. Late 80s, 90s. And people kept on calling me up. Hey, you know about Japan. You speak Japanese. I want to buy something from Japan. I want to sell something to Japan. So I started my own small consulting company. I thought, I'll do this for a while and I'll go and be a professor later. And then I was headhunted later by Judge Lang Wooten. Mm-hmm. Somehow, Corn Ferry, actually, I think it was Corn Ferry, found me in Australia. I might have that wrong now. I can't remember. Anyway, one of the big recruiting companies found me. And Jones Lang Wooten was looking for someone to run their Queensland operation for Japan business. So this is, office towers, five-star hotels, shopping centers, golf courses, this type of thing. And so I joined. And that was tremendous. It was like an MBA for me. It was a very realistic business world, big real estate, big ticket items. And I really enjoyed it. But then the, Japan bubble sort of faded a bit. And the foreign direct investment just petered out. And with it, my job petered out too, So then, it was not so good. Then as it turned out, there was a job going with Austrade to open up a brand new operation in Japan. Mm-hmm. And in those days, and David, you could count on the fingers of one hand the number of Australians who had the experience to open up a brand new operation in Japan, which is not a very common experience for Australians, at least anyway. And I thought, well, I'll learn a lot if I take this on. So I took it on, and they sent me to Nagoya. I was 4 years in Nagoya. I did very well. And then they promoted me to take over. You had to apply contract. I was on contract, 4-year contract for Nagoya. Then I got a 4-year contract for Osaka. I did very well. And they said, why don't you apply for Tokyo, another contract, which I did. And then eventually I ran Japan for Austrade. And the problem with that business is you're working for the government, you're a diplomat, but you're doing trade work. Yeah. That's okay. But you run out of runway. They say, well, Greg, you've been here for 12 years.
Yeah.
You've got to go home or you've got to go to another country. And I'd done very well, and I could have had the pick. Like if I said Milano, I love Italy, I want to go to Milano, I would have gone to Milano. Mm. But thinking about it, you know, my son had just been born, and I thought, no, I don't really. I mean, I speak Japanese, you know. I don't speak Italian. And if I go to Milano, what value do I bring to the Milano team as a trade, you know, senior trade commissioner? Not much. And I thought, well, here I have value, but I couldn't keep going. I'd run it. In our system, in Oz in the trade area, you could not become the ambassador.
Yeah.
That's the diplomatic route. I just would, in a million years, that just never happens.
Mm.
Different part of the equation. So there was no way out. I was number two level in the embassy below the ambassador with some other ministers. There are other ministers too, but I couldn't become number one. So as it turned out, I got scouted by Shinsei Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the Shinsei Bank and I thought, well, you know, it's in the retail bank. I'm not creating product, so it's not complex stuff. And if the consumer can understand, I'm sure I can understand it. So, and I really enjoyed that. I really liked Shinsei Bank. And then I got this is again, Korn Ferry scouted me to take over and run the National Australia Bank. And at that time, I thought, well, oh, this is good, National Australia Bank. This could be an avenue to go back to Australia. And I thought my son, by that time, be ready for high school. Maybe he can do it down there in Brisbane and go home, which is where I was sort of thinking, oh, National Australia Bank, there's a good connection, get back home, you know. In the end, it didn't turn out like that. In the end, I decided to stay in Japan and keep going here. And then I joined National Australia Bank 2007, just in time for Lehman Shock.
Yeah.
What a nightmare that turned out to be. What a nightmare, because the credit and risk departments just took over the whole bank.
Hmm.
You couldn't get anything done. It was just pathetic. And so I was so frustrated with it. It's a 40,000-person animal. It's a big machine, you know. Retail banking is, you know, like those rollers. You see there's a big stone wheel on the front. They just roll over everything and pick up the money.
Yeah.
Incredible. And I sort of got burnt out with having a boss based in Hong Kong who seemed to think he knew everything about Japan when he came here and visited. It's just like, you know, my age and stage, what am I putting up with this stuff?
Yeah.
I think I'm done with this. So that's when I thought I should work for myself. So I bought the franchise for Dale Carnegie for Tokyo. And I've been doing that. I bought it in 2007 with some partners, and then I joined the business in 2010, so I've been doing it now for 14 years as the president. And, you know, I mean, you have ups and downs. You have earthquakes, you know, you have Lehman Shock earthquakes. You have COVID, you know, pandemics. It's not been a smooth ride, especially COVID was hard, I think, in the training industry in general because you couldn't do face-to-face. Mm. And it was one of those sort of catch-22 conversations with Japanese clients, you know. Oh, look, we don't think that online training works. No problem. Come into the classroom. We'll all wear masks. Oh, no. We can't do that. COVID. It's like, okay. You don't want to do it online. You don't want to do it face-to-face. Mm. What are you going to do? We'll do nothing. And that was for a lot of Japanese domestic companies exactly the answer they came up. And they did nothing for like 3 or 4 years.
Mm.
Geishke companies, foreign companies, they're like, okay, good, we'll switch it over to online or we'll do it with masks on in the classroom. They were more flexible around it. So, but it did have a devastating impact on our business. And because I'm an absolute genius leader, absolute visionary, in January 2020, I hired 4 new people.
Oh, geez.
You know, and then February, late February, I was having a conversation with one of our guys in the States who looks after the franchises.
Yeah.
And we're talking about COVID, the pandemic. And he said, because we thought it was going to be like the flu, you know.
Yeah, nothing's going to happen.
We thought it was just like we had the sort of bird flu before and, you know, Japan just sailed through that, no problem. Going to be like that, right? However, our colleagues in China were reporting, this is not the bird flu. This is different and it's really, really bad. And that's when we realized, oh, okay, right, we've got to change our thinking. So we switched over. Fortunately for us, this is just luck in a way. I guess preparation produces the luck you want. But Dale Carnegie in America had been doing online delivery from about 2010 onwards.
Mm.
So by the time we got to 2020, that had 10 years of experience with this. They had developed a lot of materials specifically for online delivery for trainers. And they'd worked out you need a trainer and a producer to separate the roles. So the trainer can just concentrate on the people in the class, and the producer takes care of all the other stuff. So they had a very good system. So we had to, being Dale Carnegie, of course, we had to get everyone accredited. So within 2 weeks, we had all the producers accredited, we had all the trainers accredited, had to go through accreditation, go through training, pass it to be able to do that. And for the first classes, we did, I remember, first class we were running, it was a free class on stress management. And we'd done this before with the earthquake in 2011 because everyone was freaking out. You remember, we were having 6, 7, 8 major earthquakes a day, which we call aftershocks. And you hear the word aftershock, you think that's just a little tumble there, you know, it's like nothing. And these are like major earthquakes, 7 times a day. You couldn't concentrate. It was freaking me out, right? So we said, okay, we had that experience of running stress management classes for free for our clients and then publicly for anybody. Let's do that again. And so the first one we do is a stress management program. We did 5 full dress rehearsals for that first delivery.
Wow.
Like really serious, you know, 1 hour full on. And we're going, okay, we went through, what happened with the tech? What were the issues with the tech? What was the quality of the delivery, you know, We analyzed everything and we did that 5 times, so we're ready to go. One thing we didn't realize was that we were using WebEx at that time. That WebEx had 150-person limit or something on how many people could go online at the same time. We broke it, you know, because had so many people signing up for it. We didn't realize that. And I was like, oh, really? There's a limit on this thing, all right? And then gradually we learned. And we did that for a couple of years, of course, and now we're back to face-to-face. We still do some online delivery for some clients, so we can do that. But, you know, I think face-to-face has got a certain dynamic to it. So that was a rocky period through COVID, and we still haven't come out, really. We haven't got back to where we were pre-COVID yet in terms of our revenues. We're still, you know, under where we were. So Japan is a bit slow. And because we're a franchise organization, every month we see the revenue results of every franchise in the world, and it's all converted to US dollars. Okay. So it's some sort of similarity there. But what we noticed was that in a lot of other countries, a lot of other franchises, you know, it goes down over COVID. As soon as COVID's over, officially over, spikes. Still waiting for the spike. It's grumbling along.
That's interesting.
It's not spiked back up yet. It's grumbling along, but it has a spike. But other countries, it spikes straight away. They're back, you know. Japan, a bit more conservative, a bit slower, a bit harder. I think for a lot of clients, the CFO took that money out of that cell in the P&L for training and put it somewhere else, and they haven't put it back yet. You know, I think that's part of the problem. But I think over time it'll right itself. We'll get back to it. But it's been, you know, it's been a hard road to hoe since 2020, I can tell you that. But we're getting there. We're getting there.
Well, I'm glad you're back, and you've got a new book. So talk about your leadership book and what's brought you to that.
I started, this is my 8th book. The first one I wrote was on sales, and you have some great books, your Sweet series, you know, Sweet Sales and your Sweet series of books. And I wrote a book for selling in Japan because I realized that the Japanese negotiator title, there was a book called The Japanese Negotiator. You probably got a copy. I've got a copy. That was written like 35 years ago. And because everyone is sort of enamored with China, no one was writing about Japan. So I decided to write a book on selling in Japan. And I wrote that book, and then we decided we'd translate it. According, English title is, you know, Japan Sales Mastery. The Japanese title is Za, which becomes Za Eigyo. Very simple title. Translated that. And then in the process of writing that, I realized also that no one has been writing about doing business in Japan. You can find a lot of videos on YouTube about how to sit in the room and do the Meishi exchange and this sort of stuff. It's all good stuff, but nothing really solid. So I decided to write a second book for that audience of people who don't know Japan but want to understand how to do business here, called Japan Business Mastery. So it was a shorter book. I did that. The next one was Japan Presentations Mastery, which is one I think I gave you a copy of last time, right? And then we translated that to Prezen or Tatsujin, you know, and we translated that. And so I'd always wanted to do the next one on leadership, and we will translate this one. So the thinking here is, this is my take on things, so people can disagree with me, but I don't think that OJT, the famous on-the-job training, Japanese system of training, is working anymore. And the reason I don't think it's working is this. When the WAPRO, came in, where you had a computer that you could type in Japanese, came in, and the secretaries went out. No more secretarial pool, that's gone. No company has a secretarial pool anymore. And what happens? The boss is doing their own typing. And also, you have do your own typing, and you've got email. So now internet, email. Bosses are incredibly busy people.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, the boss was your mentor. The boss would teach you how to do things, and your senpais would teach you how to do things. That system's basically broken down because everybody is very, very preoccupied with doing their own work. Mm. Time management skills are a problem for everyone, and I think for a lot of Japanese leaders too. So their time management skills aren't good. They'd have to do a lot of stuff themselves. They don't have a lot of support. So their actual time to mentor someone, to upskill someone, has really dropped off a cliff. Mm. So a lot of people are coming through the system. They're getting very little guidance. And so they, you know, the Japanese escalator system, okay, year five or year seven or year eight or whatever it is, now you're a section head or whatever it might be, and you become a, you know, a kacho or kacho dai, or you become a bucho or whatever it might be. But you actually haven't had any real preparation for that. And so you're cobbling together what you can to try and make it work. Now, and this is great news for your industry, the shortage of people means that the recruiting and retain part become very, very important for leaders. So if you aren't a skilled leader and you're not good with people and you're not good at communicator, people are going to leave you. Because we know they leave bosses. They don't leave, you know, companies. They leave bosses, right? And they'll be a very helpful recruiter to find a new home for you somewhere else. And they will. So the problem from the boss point of view is if you aren't doing a good job to really sell your people on the job and staying there and they leave, replacing them is a nightmare because there just aren't that many people available. And the quality's not going down rapidly. As you and I both know, Once upon a time, getting into a Japanese university was relatively difficult. What's happening to all these private universities? Backsides on seats is what they're after. Where's the money? So you can get in. Now, Waseda, Keio, Todai, Kyodai, Hokudai, okay, different thing. But for your other universities, it's a zero-sum game of trying to get, and they will drop their standards, take anybody who's got fee-paying ability. So we, as employers, are going to have less quality people coming through and less numbers of them. So the ability of middle management to retain people becomes very important. That's your ability to have good human relations skills, good communication skills, and good ability to lead people and have a vision, you know, get people behind that, find out what they need and then supply it and show that you care about them. So I wrote this book. This book is really a combination of my own experiences and all the mistakes I've made as a leader, they're all in there. Plus, I took a Dale Carnegie core courses on leadership, and then I put my take on it, I should say it that way, right? It's like a toolkit. This is very good for existing leaders who need to skill up. If you're a new leader, it's probably bit early for you because one of the problems is for new leaders, you need something a little bit different. This is for someone who's been leading, has, you know, I say, has bled from, you know, every orifice basically and understood how hard it is to lead. When you're a new leader, you read something like this, you go, oh yeah, intellectually, I've got it, right? But you haven't suffered yet. When you've suffered and you read this, you go, ah, that's the missing piece of the puzzle. That's how you do that. And it really helps people to fill in the gap. So I think for middle managers, this is very, very good, very helpful.
Okay. Yeah, I find when I do a lot of coaching for mid-management, and there's a huge gap with, they have good communication skills, they want to do the right things, they're out trying to get knowledge. But the challenge is they don't know how to work out or up. They just look at their team and they're good hands-on people. And then you get kind of the bucho level and they want only strategy, hands-off. They don't really want to do anything else. And there's that finding that leadership mix in between is a consistent struggle for all the businesses that I've come in contact with. It seems like there's just missing that skill set.
Well, we have a course called Leadership Training for Managers, which this book is based on that course, plus other stuff that I've come across myself. But we notice that when we teach it, it's like a real aha moment for a lot of leaders. They realize, I've got parts of the puzzle here, but I didn't have this bit. I didn't know about this bit. I hadn't any clue about what to do about this bit. So it sort of fleshes out the thing in full form for them. And then it gives them, it's got a lot of structures. You know, Dale Carnegie's not a prescriptive type of training company of here's your scripts or here's how you've got to do this. We have a lot of open structures, I would call it. Like this building we're in now, it has a concrete floor, has a concrete ceiling above us, but you've outfitted it to your taste and reflect your thinking. It's like that. We give you the structure. It has a floor and a ceiling, but what goes into the fit out, that's you. Mm-hmm. That's your design, your taste, your authenticity. So it gives enough freedom for you to flesh it out, but it gives you structure to know what to do. So we try and have that balance and we do it that way. So I think that's important for leaders to be able to draw on their success and incorporate that into what we're doing and give them a roadmap, basically, on where they can go, what they need to do, and give them the basic skills that they're missing. Because things like how to get innovation from your team. As you know, you talked about Japan's Top Business Interviews, a podcast I do with CEOs, and you've been a guest. Thank you. When I do that, I often ask the guest, you know, do you have a system, ideation system? Do you have some methodology for getting ideas? Apart from you, there are very few leaders who actually have a system.
Huh.
Yeah, very few. And that's always a bit surprising to me. So we have a system, you know, and we teach that system in that program. So that's quite useful. We teach how to do delegation. For a lot of leaders, their idea of delegation is you come along with a big, thick folder, whoop, you drop it on the desk and say, fix that up, you know, by Friday, and disappear. That's not going to work. And then when it doesn't work, the conclusion is, well, delegation doesn't work. I'll be faster. I do it myself. And they do it themselves. So there's a big gap there between their knowledge of what they can do and their time usage, and they're doing it in an ineffective way because they don't know any better. Or handling mistakes, you know, if you're trying to retain people and there are going to be errors, how do you keep the people, keep them going? Or, you know, how do you become a good communicator? How do you coach people? All these really concrete skill sets that are not normally taught in the OJT system, I think, come out in a book like this. So I think these are things that we need in Japan. I'm just saying to myself, you know, this shortage of people is not getting better. I mean, the Japanese government, I think it's their fourth time round now. They have a program to try and have 150,000 young Japanese get degrees overseas and about 230,000 study overseas a year.
Mm-hmm.
I say the fourth time around. Last three have all failed. At the moment, there's about 60,000 Japanese go overseas to study for degrees. We're looking for bilingual staff. We're looking for international staff. Where are they going to come from? You know, so, and it used to be that we only had competition with ourselves. But when, you know, Japan Inc. decided, well, we've got to go overseas and we've got to get out of this dying market and we've got to buy up companies and we've got to expand, suddenly they're competing with us for these same people because they need them in their organization. So that small pool that's getting smaller and smaller has got more and more competition. This is going to be hard for all of us. So I think this is where if the leaders aren't being properly organized, you're going to lose people and they're going to be very hard to replace. You know yourself. You and I talk to yourself and others in your industry. They say we have no shortage of demand. We have a shortage of candidate supply, and that's not going to get better. So this is, I think, survival type of issues that companies have got to deal with. And their leaders, middle management leaders in particular, are going to be the solution for that if they're working well.
Yeah. I was reading for my son, we talked about earlier, my son graduated from KO. Over 85% of students in their second year had job offers.
Wow.
So these kids, by the time they're in their fourth year, there's a fight for talent at the university level. It's not even getting into the management level. And so,
and 30% of them are leaving their companies in their third and fourth year after they've joined them. So they're recruited early, they come in, and then one third of them who've been trained are walking out the door to the competitor.
Yep.
So if you think about that, and I think that number is going to go up.
I do too.
Because I find today, once upon a time, in the good old days, I'd get literally resumes, you know, sort of yay high, like a half a meter high. And I'd very, you know, carefully go through them and, you know, don't want that one. I have a big selection pool. And then I interview people. I have lots of interviews and I pick the people I want. Today, the number of resumes I get, minuscule. The options, very, very few. The quality, not very good. So, you know, what do you do about that in terms of these people are moving around, which is good, more mobility. But I think that mobility part will go up. But on the one side, you've got to keep your people and they don't join the pool, you know, and you get the pool from somebody else's, you know, they're losing. So I feel they're interviewing me.
Yeah.
More than I'm interviewing them today.
Yeah, it's, most of the candidates get, even so-so candidates now are getting 15, 20, 30% pay raises and 3 to 5, you know, offers. And it's just amazing.
But well, I had a guy come and see me, introduced by one of these major bilingual specialist recruiting companies. I won't say the name. Well, and I told the recruiter, I said, you know, we need to have someone who presents well, because this is part of our brand, professional. Guy comes in. He's got a perm that's gone wrong. It looks like a perm that's growing out. It's a catastrophe of a hairdo. His suit doesn't fit properly. Looks terrible. His shoes are not shined. He's got, in the interview, he's got the jacket off. He's got his sleeves rolled up to the elbow. I'm looking at, no tie. I'm looking at this guy like, this is how you prepped for a job interview? Have you got any common sense at all? None. So he's out, you know. But he, you know, he had job offers from other companies. As he was, you know, situated, no problem, come and join us. It's like, wow, you know, no way. And that's the problem. The quality goes down, the choices go down, you become compromise really on trying to maintain your brand, your credibility, your professionalism. The things that are going to grow your business are going to be deteriorating. And I think for all of us, this is going to be a hard, hard year to hoe here. And it just won't get any easier going forward.
I think we'll look at changing to hiring foreigners a lot more is what I see. And I think technology is going to play a big part in shifting a lot of jobs, because you just don't need as many bilingual persons anymore, because things are global and technology can take care of a lot of that. So
shocked at how good the AI translation has become. Like once upon a time, you put something through, say something like Google Translate or something, it was like gobbledygook, you know, what those kids trying to say. And then I sort of didn't touch it for a long time. And then for some reason I put something through it. I was shocked, like, oh my God, that's very good, you know. And I think that if you're in the translation business, they're all using it.
Yep.
And we, because our headquarters in New York is producing content in English, it comes to us, we filter it for context, we filter it for culture, and then we translate it into Japanese. And so whether the translating company gives it to us or AI gives it to us, we still got to go through it ourselves and Dale Carnegie-fy it, if there's such a word, so that's contextual with how we, you know, our point of view and how we speak. So that, you know, that type of thing, I think the advantage, I mean, this book, we use a translation company for presentations mastery, you know, Anatomo Tatsujin, a presenter Tatsujin, for the translation. This one, we'll put it through straight through AI.
Wow.
Straight through AI. We won't bother a translation company this time. We'll put it straight through. And then we ourselves, because we have a lot of, you know, talented people, and they'll check the Japanese is correct and it's the right type of Japanese. But I'm shocked at how much it improved it has. In fact, with your books, did you do the audio as well? Did you do audio versions?
So I sold them to a publisher, so the publisher took care
of. And they did audio for
They did audio for that, and it was, they hired it.
Did you do the?
I didn't do the reading.
Narration yourself,
no?
I did it for Japan Sales Mastery, and David, that was hard
work. It's tough work. I didn't want...
I can't believe how hard work it is to be a narrator. It's like because you're putting your energy into it and it's the books, you know, numbers of chapters and whew. And then it's got to be edited, of course. And I did one. I said, damn. No, I want AI to do the next one. And in fact, I attended, I think it was... I think it was Amazon, some big shot from Amazon was here. I went to a thing, it was an American Chamber event, and this guy was talking about what they were doing with this narration through AI. They weren't talking much about AI, but it was automated narration. And I asked the guy, you know, like, when's this going to be ready type of thing? And it wasn't ready then, but it's ready now. Yep. Although Audible will not accept AI-created audio content at this point. And I think when that goes away, that opens up. And I would love to have the machine do my book in an Oxbridge accent rather than my Aussie accent and do it that way, because I can tell you it was slog. And I looked at presentations, Martin, and said, nope, I'm not doing it. Just such hard work. I mean, it's great that you do it yourself because you're the author and you know – you know the cadence you want. You know which words to emphasize. Yes, but man, it's tough. It's tough. So I'll hang in there a bit longer to see what happens about the AI narration.
That's why I'm glad the publisher took care of it. I think one of the opportunities, one of the things I love about Dale Carnegie, like you said, it's a prescriptive, descriptive, not a prescriptive.
Yeah, descriptive, not prescriptive, yeah.
And so many training systems, they give you the five steps to be effective or whatever. And now with things like AI, the skill sets that Dale Carnegie laid out even 100 years ago are still applicable because they are descriptive and they teach people how to behave in ambiguity, how to lead. And I think that's more of what our leaders need now than it is knowing there isn't an answer. No one's ever worked with AI before, but you need to be able to embrace it and learn that tool because the tool is important, but it's just a tool as well. And I think so many leaders are afraid by new tools, whether it's AI or any other thing, and just step back because they want to, they want the MBA answer, they want the five-step answer, and there isn't one. And that's an interesting...
It is interesting. I mean, with Dale Carnegie too, you know, you've got sons, you know, children, children as well. And what I notice is that somehow... the human species is not very smart, and our ability to pass knowledge on from generation to generation is limited by your son saying, I already know, or you're out of date, Dad, or Dad, you don't know. And so you would think the most famous book by Dale Carnegie is How to Win Friends and Influence People, published in 1936, published in Japanese in 38. You would think with that core knowledge, we would all be fantastic in communication. We'd all be fantastic with each other in human relations. No. And what I realized with my son was trying to pass knowledge on to him, which isn't going anywhere, I realized, okay, every generation has to relearn the same things, you know, and we have to rediscover for ourselves and have to, you know, make the same mistakes and benefit from learning through our mistakes. So there's that aspect, I think, of generational learning. And I think also for, as you say, with that this descriptive nature of things, what we are doing is we are pumping all of our IP into our own small language model, not a large language model, a small language model. And the reason for that is I use, you know, Claude, I use ChatGPT. Great, but often generic. And often it's like, well, okay, where did this answer come from? Can I trust this answer? I'm not just talking about hallucinations. I'm talking, they're drawing on the entire universe of materials they can score. What we're saying is, okay, if you like Dale Carnegie and you want the Dale Carnegie point of view, then we'll give it to you from within our world of our IP as a curated answer, as opposed to an in the wild answer, in the wild west answer that you get today. And I use AI quite a bit, and I see what comes up, and some's good, and some's not so good, and some's wrong, totally wrong. So I'm hoping that we can provide some value add for our clients, that they can get an answer for their participants in their classes they're looking for from our point of view. If they trust what we think, you'll get it from us. So we're heading down that road, and we're just in the process now of pouring all this stuff into the machine, which then becomes searchable. Because one of the problems is we have white papers, good. We have ebooks, great. We have hundreds of manuals. We have textbooks. We have whole training courses. We have modules. We call them CBDS modules. They're just two-hour modules. We have my books. We have, what else do we have? We have an array of stuff, but you can't search it. If you want to find out what's in that manual, you've got to go to the manual. You've got to go to the white paper. You've got to go to the ebook. You've got to go to the book. What this will do, it will free up the answer to be brought to you from all of that, which at the moment we can't get an answer. You know, if I'm looking for something for some client to deliver a training, I have to go to the manual. We have titles. So I look at what's a prospective title that will work for that particular issue, and I'll go, and then I have to go in the manual and look and find out, okay, what's this manual got in here? Will this cover it? And is this going to be suitable, depending on what we're doing, unless it's a course, and a course is already fixed. So I think in that sense, what we're doing, I think, will become standard, because what's happened is in the last 12 months, we've had HR directors, HR, L&D people come to us and say, do you have any on-demand training? And my first question to them is, yes, but do you know what the completion rate is for on-demand delivered training? None of them know. So, well, you know, it's around about 3% completion rate. It's extremely low. But as you know, you deal with HR people too, they've got to complete the process and tick that box that says, yes, we provide on-demand training for our participants, regardless of whether actually anyone completes it or it's worthwhile or not. So we've been doing a lot of work on creating truckloads of on-demand content for our clients. Great. But I also realized, I thought, you know what? HR, L&D, they're at the sort of on-demand stage now. How long before they come to me and say, well, Greg, we want to access all your IP for our participants? I don't know how, I don't know at what point I'm going to get that first inquiry, but we're not waiting. We're going now. We're going to spend the money and we go now. And because we've got a very big curriculum, because we do leadership and we do sales and we do presentations and we do communication and we do DEI. And we do executive coaching. So our spectrum is very, very big compared to someone who only does sales or only does leadership or only does presentations or only does communication or only does DEI, right? Diversity, equity, inclusion. So in that sense, as a training company, we have an advantage of having this, hopefully, I'm hoping this is the case, critical enough mass that when you search it, you can get an answer that's useful, effective, and coherent. Don't know yet. We'll get there, but, you know, this is the future. So I think, and feeding the machine, that's a massive job too. It's like, wow, this is no, not for the lighthearted here, it's serious stuff. So, but, you know, once you've fed it, basically it's fed. Now I've also got something like, what am I up to about? I'm going to say 1,600, maybe, how many, maybe more, 1,700 podcasts. They go in there. They go in there. We've got over nearly 3,000 videos on YouTube that goes in there. So we've got a lot of stuff, you know, actually, we built up. So in that sense, we're a small language model, but it's relatively, compared to maybe some other training companies, I think it's pretty big. So hopefully it's going to be useful to clients, but I just think the demand is going to come. Someone's going to say, well, can we access your IP? And I'm going to say, yes.
It's a good model. I think it'll be there. And it's already happening globally, so it just takes time in Japan. There are a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about. One is, it seems now in Japan that, let's back up. 10 years ago, when you're out of a job, you became a consultant for 2-3 years until you got that position. Now it seems that everybody's going out and being a coach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of coaches out there in the world.
Yep.
For better or worse, I think.
I'm particularly in love with the 32-year-old life coach.
Don't get me started on. I'll answer part of my question before I answer it. Don't hire a coach who's younger than you, who hasn't done what you're wanting to do. It's like for marathon running, I get a coach for a marathon. Why would I hire someone that's not run a marathon or hasn't run at a speed that I want to improve me? There's some good coaches in the world, don't get me wrong. For our listeners, what would you suggest when they're looking for a coach?
I'm going to be potentially controversial.
Of course you are. That's why I'm asking you the question.
And I'm going to say that I think there are two varieties of coaches available to you, and I think you should steer away from one of them and go for the other. And those two varieties, in my experience, are, and all these certifying organizations produce this first variety of coach, which is the, I'll ask you a series of questions, and you will be stimulated to search through your own thinking and come up with an answer. And I will provide nothing from my side about my experience or my insight or my ideas to help you. And the other variety of coach is that more mentor, someone who's been in the line of fire, in the mud and the blood and the tears, has got the wounds and the scars, you know, through having had the experience. And they can bring that to you as well as asking questions. Now, I had a case where someone was being accredited in one of these big organizations to become a coach. And they asked me if I would be a participant in the coaching session. I tell you, David, I found it very frustrating just being asked questions continuously. I mean, okay, very good to stimulate my thinking. Yeah, good, good, good. But I'd say, you do this with a lot of people. What have you seen? What has been your experience? Tell me some insight. I was looking for more value add here than just asking Mick. And that just, all you get is another question.
Mm.
You know, I found that very frustrating. Now, my advice would be don't look for a coach who can only ask you questions for you to self-discover. That is important. I'm not saying a coach shouldn't do that. But I'm saying try and find a coach who has got, as you say, track record, experience. They've done it. They can save you time, effort, tears, you know, by having, at least they can give you insight. Now, I'll give you an example. I'm coaching a very senior executive from a very major Japanese corporation. And we started down the track of, sort of just basic coaching. And it has completely moved across to something else now. And it's really on the mentor side and not just about work. You know, it's about a lot of things now. And we've got a very strong relationship and the trust is there. And we can talk very frankly about some very deep personal things. I think that type of coach gives you more value. It's much harder to be able to be that mentor. You have to have, as I say, you've got to have the runs on the board. You've got to be around. That's why I say 32 life age life coach? Are you kidding me? Seriously? Oh, I've got all my coaching credentials. Bully for you. What have you done? What have you seen? You know, you're too young. I get a coaching somebody who's 20 years of age. Maybe that's okay. You know, but anybody more senior, I just can't see how that works. So sorry to all those life coaches out there who are quite young and being a life coach, but I just don't see how that's, I mean, unless you're coaching very young people, I don't think that's appropriate. So I would say to people, look for a mentor, someone who can bring insight, save you time, give you ideas, suggestions, things that are going to add more value to that experience. And certainly, if someone says to me, I want coaching, I say to them, I say, well, there are two types of coaches. You got this type of coach, you got this type of coach. I don't do just the asking questions type because I find it boring.
Right.
I do this type of coaching. If that's the sort of coaching you want, yes. If I've got bandwidth to do it, because as you and I both know, you can't do a lot of coaching as a business leader because it sucks up so much time. And frankly, the money compared to what you'd get out of your own business investing in the time there isn't worth it. I do it to help people, but I control how much of it I do because I just know there's a trade-off there that's just not worth it. So I'm very selective on who I decide to
get. High fiver on that.
On that one?
We did an American thing, and it reminds me of when we sat down for lunch at Shinsei, we were talking, and like, oh, we both do training, PhD, both did karate, and done it for 50 years. But I agree with you 100%. Young people, it's fine. I think there's some young people that have some great experience, and if they have that experience, they can go in and do it. But I think it's really looking at someone that gives value add beyond just that asking questions. I think you're spot on. On the same vein of asking for insights into Japan, a lot of our listeners are HQ, global. They're trying to crack the black box that's Japan of hiring oftentimes, and that's when they come to us. So your expertise is in sales and leaders.
Mm-hmm.
What could you give advice for those people that are looking how to break into Japan, get the right leaders, get the right salespeople? What are they? Because oftentimes they'll hear, we can't do that in Japan, or yeah, that doesn't exist in Japan, or there's we all know the phrases that have been told to HQ or to APAC. But it's not always the case. What would guidance would you give those people that are trying to look in?
One of the, you probably see this more than I do, but one of the things that I noticed previously was that you had the, it's Japan. So we have to have a Japanese president.
Yep.
So they hire someone who's retiring or retirement age from their Japanese corporate to come in and be the president because they've got the connections, they've got the experience. And what they often do is they take Japan and make it even more of an island in the universe of that company that it already was before, and they run their own show, and no one knows what on earth's going on in Japan because they won't communicate, and then the results are not there, and they panic, and they just, oh, gee, what are we going to do? These days, I think, there are quite a lot of very accomplished bilingual foreign leaders here who've been running big organizations who should be looked at. Because often the foreigner card, to play the foreigner card, is a useful thing because we get a margin extended to us as foreigners that Japanese don't. And we can push boundaries in a way that our Japanese staff can't, or even a Japanese shacho can't. So I think there's that aspect. But I think if you're looking for some, and equally with Japanese who've been working overseas, they're internationalized, they're very comfortable with how things work, they're good in communication, they're trying to make a fiefdom in Japan, they do want to run it properly. They're also very, very valuable, and they exist, and there's a lot of them. I know many of them, and they're very capable people. So I think you've got a pool of internationalized Japanese who get it, and you've got a very big pool now of foreigners who have been here a long time. I've been here 40 years, you know, who get it. Maybe, you know, a long time ago that wasn't available to you, but today it's quite available. The other thing is I think you have to support the Japan operation more closely. You can't just say, okay, you're now the president, where you go. You've got to be flexible about changing things to suit Japan's need. And one of the big learnings you have in Japan, I think, is when you come into the business And there are some things that seem a bit odd, or this seems expensive, why are we doing it this way, or this is not very effective, and you just can't quite work it out. But you find that your team are very dogmatic about protecting that and not changing anything. Well, what's wrong with these people? We're very stubborn. I better fire these people, get some people in here who know how to make things happen, right? If you go and talk to the clients, if you go and talk to your buyers, that's when you discover why your own team is being dogmatic, because they're very closely aligned with the needs of the buyers.
Yeah.
And they're trying to really serve them extremely well. And the buyers have certain demands. And so they sort of force your machine to make some adjustments, which for you make no sense, but from the Japanese buyer's point of view, makes sense. So I think if you send in people who maybe they don't know Japan, they're not bilingual, but give them the freedom of time to get results. So the idea is, hey, look, David, we're sending you to Japan. We fired that Japanese president. It wasn't getting any results, but you have to get results. And we're expecting numbers. We expect to see things turn around, and we want it fast, David, fast, because if you don't get it fast, you are out.
Yep.
That's a ridiculous equation for Japan, just a ridiculous equation. So that set of expectations makes no sense. And in my book, Japan Business Mastery, the last chapter is devoted to the expat leader. It's a warning chapter. Do not take the job until you read this chapter.
Good.
And do not take this job until you negotiate with your company and your boss some margin for you to have the ability to succeed in Japan. And don't just be given marching orders like that, which are going to absolutely guarantee you fail. Don't do it like that. So I think you need to have the support from headquarters to have time to really understand the business, understand the people, understand the complications of what your clients are asking you to do, understand the regulatory framework, you know, understand the sort of just-in-time system of supply here, the, you know, supply chain, because I know you do a lot on supply chain. These things are different. Yep. These are totally different. So until you understand all that, the pieces of the puzzle don't make a lot of sense. But once you get it, then you realize, okay. But headquarters has to understand that, and they have to support you. But often what you get is, look, don't play that Japan's different card with me, sunshine. You have to make it work. Well, hello, you're sitting in Hong Kong, or probably increasingly now Singapore, because they're all departing from Hong Kong.
They're moving to Bangkok now.
Bangkok, is it, right? Or somewhere in, you know, headquarters in Europe or the States, wherever. Thinking you have any clue about what's going on in Japan, well, that's just delusionary.
Yeah.
You cannot understand it. And yes, it is different. Accept that it's different and listen to your people and support them for the things that they need to do to make it work, because there's no shortage of examples of people who have made major mistakes trying to make the way they do it in Europe or America fit for Japan, and wondering why the Japanese buyer doesn't go for it, be it heavy manufacturing or consumer goods or whatever it might be. So there's no shortage of hard lessons being learned along those lines. So I would say be more supportive of the people you send. Look for Japanese who've been internationalized and worked overseas. Look for foreigners who, you know, like me, been here a long time, like you. You know, you and I could run any corporation here.
Yep.
I think, no matter what the business was, because we know how Japan works, we know how to get on with people, we know how to communicate, we've got the whole puzzle. We're not available because we work for ourselves. But there are lots of people like us today that are available. So that would be my advice.
Great. Yeah, we had a client coming in from Europe that they wanted a Japanese leader because they were dealing with a Japanese customer. And so they, and in sales, I think you and I both agree that oftentimes you need a Japanese face to go and, and talk to the customer. And we said, if you want to succeed in Japan, go and hire a foreigner. Your first employee's got to be a foreigner who's going to drive the business, be honest with headquarters. And then your second employee, let them bring in their salesperson who's going to face off. Because then, like you said, the foreigner can play the foreign card a lot, change some rules as they need, and then you can bring in that person that they trust to really drive the business.
We can say dumb things.
Absolutely.
We can say controversial things. We can push on things in a way that our Japanese staff can't. I'll give you an example. You are a great networker. I'm a great networker. This is part of our fabric of our business, to find new clients, and so we have to become very good at it. When I go to Japanese-only events. Mm-hmm. Usually I'm the only foreigner there. What do I notice about the Japanese? They only talk to people they know.
Yeah.
So if you and I know each other, we're Japanese, we know each other, and someone comes that you know, you introduce them to me. But for me to walk up to somebody I don't know and speak to them directly, very rarely you see that happen. So for my Japanese staff, the same thing's difficult. For them to walk up to somebody they don't know, I mean, I encourage them to do that. I try and drive them to do that. I try to train them to do that. But what's easier for them is if I walk up to somebody, and this is the body language when I walk up to them, literally, it's this shock.
Yeah.
And I have my little technique. I have my meishia. May I meet you? In Japanese, I say in Japanese, may I meet you? And I got the meishi out. So it's obviously what I want. Mm-hmm. I want your meishi. Initially, a shocked foreigner. Oh, my God. Someone I don't know is approaching me. Who are you? But I'm a foreigner, so it's acceptable. So I meet them, exchange cards. Now, I'd like you to meet my team member, XYZ. Bingo. Off to the races, you know?
Yep.
But I'm that battering ram that can do that and pull that off. Now, as a leader here, as a president here, I can't cold call people.
Yep.
If I get on the phone and start cold calling people, I'm the president. They're going, what's wrong with this company? Why is the president cold calling me? That's not the president's job.
Mm.
Now, I'm in sales too, like you. So for me, networking is an incredibly important avenue to meet potential clients. Yep. And I do a lot of it, and I'm constantly out there doing it, trying to meet new clients. So that's my little niche that is only available for me because I have no options. But my staff, they can cold call people. Yep. They can do a lot of stuff that I can't do, right? So I think there's a balance. But I think I'm not saying they have to be a foreigner, but if you've got a foreigner who understands Japan, being here, speaks Japanese, they bring a lot of advantages, as you mentioned before. And also Japanese who've been overseas bring a lot of advantages.
Yep.
But if you're going to send out someone who doesn't know Japan, doesn't speak Japanese, then you've got to support them. Yep. That'd be my view.
That's great. We've gone through a lot of topics. Anything that I've missed that we need to cover?
No, I think, you know, we've been speaking for about an hour or so. I think we've covered a lot of topics. But I think for your global audience, I would say, like any country, any market, Japan has got challenges and has got opportunities. Mm. The opportunities here are big. It's a big economy. It's sophisticated. Everything works here. There's lots of options here. But cracking the code to get in, that's not easy.
Mm.
If you know what you're doing, you can crack it. You've got to know what you're doing, though. Don't do it the wrong way. Find out how to crack that code and find out how to build a team that's going to be effective here. And if you're using people who are coming from all different companies, you'll have no culture. No central culture, because they're all bringing their different cultures. When I was at Shinsei Bank, at one point the bell rang for me that I realized that because we're using mid-career hires, at a point in time, we had more people who were mid-career hires than we had previously been with Shinsei. So what was the culture? The dominant culture, what was the dominant culture? There was no dominant culture.
Mm.
So we had to then turn around and really work on creating a Shinsei culture that was dominant, which integrated everybody together. These things become important. So as you're hiring people, make sure you create your own company culture with your own vision, mission, values, and drive that very, very hard. So I think there's an opportunity there to train people, and I'm in the training business, so I see the benefits of training. I see the improvement in people. I see the effectiveness of people who are trained versus those who aren't. When your competitors are not training their people, they're using on-the-job training, which is ineffective, as I mentioned at the very start of this talk, train them. It's a distinct advantage. Hire good people through people like yourself who are doing, who know how to hire and where the good people are. You do that, then you're going to have the right format to be successful in Japan and crack that code. And the good thing about Japan is once you crack the code, they want to keep using you because that high degree of risk aversion, you've gone through that, you know, credibility barrier, trust barrier, predictability barrier, consistency barrier, quality barrier. You've cracked all of those. They know what they're getting. They're comfortable with what they're getting, and they want to keep using you because the risk of going to someone they don't know, even if the someone they don't know's price is cheaper than you, they are not going to take it because, as you and I know, in this country, people do not get fired for incompetence.
Yep.
So not taking on opportunities, not taking, you know, grasping the nettle, you don't get fired for that here. But if you take on something and it fails, your career is impacted. So there's an opportunity there, I think, to really work on your teams, work on your culture, train people properly, and then you will have a distinct competitive advantage against others in your domestic competitors and your international competitors. Because in a way, the field is wide open.
Yep.
The field is wide open, I think. And, you know, in a way, this is the best time to be in Japan, I think. And many, thanks to Warren Buffett, a lot of people are looking at Japan.
Yep.
Again, you know, I think, you know, China, they can arrest you in China.
Yeah.
And they are arresting people in China. Where's so-and-so? Disappeared, you know. You can't get the money out of China.
Hmm.
You don't have rule of law in China. And I think when we see how the Chinese are using trade, using business as a weapon, they've weaponized it for political purposes, people are realizing, well, this is not very stable. This is not very predictable. We need to, some people use the word decouple, some people use the word offshoring or whatever.
Yep.
I think that will continue.
Yep.
And a country like Japan has the rule of law. It has the rule of law. It's an even playing field here. And you have got capability to be successful here if you do things the right way. So I encourage people, if you're not, if you're looking at going outside of your own home country, don't give up on Japan so easily. Get the right people to help you, and then you'll be successful.
Okay. Right. I'll highlight a couple of things you said because I just think they're so important. Is from a recruitment side, if you want to retain and you want to make sure that you're hiring the best and you want to have great employer branding, get training.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just it. It's such an easy fix. Yeah. People, so many companies are like, well, recruiting's so hard. Well, if you're training, a lot of that disappears.
Mm.
A lot of that challenge disappears. And then the other thing, if you need to know about Japan, at the top of this podcast, we talked about all the podcasts you have. Yeah. Go and listen to what you're saying.
Yeah.
There's a topic there that Dr. Story's got on the World Wide Web on YouTube that you can look at for free, and that will show people how to crack that code because it's not that big a mystery.
No.
And there's enough materials out there.
Yeah, well, I have 585 podcasts released on leadership.
Oh,
I think it's 412 now, 411, 412 on sales and on presentations. I have 225 CEO interviews on one topic, leading in Japan, all free.
Yeah.
That has never existed before. And so there's no excuse. If you're leading in Japan or you're selling in Japan or you want to be a better presenter in Japan, free resources. There's no excuse. I mean, it's, you know, it's all practical. It's not theory. It's practical. Your advice on your podcast, totally practical. Today, mine. There's no theory here. It's practical. So you get the best of what's available for today, what's current today.
Mm.
Forget what's happening 30 years ago. You know, the Japanese negotiator written 35 years ago, well, that still may have some elements which are relevant, maybe not. This stuff is all free and it's available. So, you know, I really hope. I mean, I do bump into people. I was in the gym at Tokyo Marine Club the other day, and a guy came up to me with a very well beaten up copy of Japan Sales Mastery.
Nice.
Really well beaten up, and, you know, notes and whatever. He asked me to sign it. I was very touched, you know. I was happy to sign it, you know. And so when that happens to me, I'm always thinking, oh, great. Something I did was helping people, right? And I don't write books to sell books.
Yeah, it's not our business.
And you don't write books to sell books, right? Yeah. I write books to sell training. Very, very clear what I'm doing here. I don't care about how many books get sold because we give a lot of them away. And I'm going to give you this book in a moment.
Hey, I'm lucky.
Right? I give it to the clients, right? So if it's helping people, I'm happy, you know, because that's part of our DNA as trainers, as in your business too, is to help people. So it makes sense to us.
Well, thanks for dropping by and talking to me today, Greg. It's always great.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm doing the up, down, low, down, down.